Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Jeremy Zettelmeyer, the director of Bruegel. Today, we're going to speak about the US Inflation Reduction Act, passed last summer, that has triggered a big reaction in Europe and elsewhere, both of the, you know, excited and positive kind and of the critical sort. And with me to dig through, you know, the complications and the excitement of this debate are two fantastic experts from both sides of the Atlantic. We have Kimberly Clausing, who holds the Eric M. Zolt Chair in Tax Law and Policy at the University of California in Los Angeles. And Kim was previously the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for tax analysis, serving as the lead economist in the Office of Tax Policy during the first part of the Biden administration. Kim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And then we have Sébastien Jean for this conversation as well. So Sébastien is the Jean-Baptiste Say Chair of Industrial Economics at the Conservatoire National des Arts et Métiers in Paris. I think you have had this for about a year now, Sébastien, and before you were director of CEPI, which is the leading French think tank on international economics. Welcome, Sébastien.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to speak about a big legislative package that is the Biden administration's signature legislation on climate change. But as we're going to discover in the course of the podcast, it also has big implications for trade. And Kim has worked about that. She's will publish about that. She is writing about that. And Sébastien has also published and is thinking about that. And so we really want to elucidate both aspects, the climate action part of the IRA, the spillovers of the IRA, and why this affects trade policy and why it is in part controversial. But in order to get there, we have to start with some basic facts. And I'm just going to ask Kim, tell us a little bit about what is actually in the IRA or IRA and why it is there. So there are sort of various pots of subsidies. There are trade policy measures that are linked to those subsidies. There are things that are specifically against China. So it is mostly a climate package, but one that comes with a certain mix of things. And of course, that has to do with the political moment in which the IRA was passed. So can you tell us a little bit both of what's in there and about the background?
Sure, absolutely. So the IRA has a slew of tax credits that are targeted toward clean energy, and it totals more than $250 billion in lost revenues due to those tax credits over the coming decade. It also has some direct spending, which is estimated at about $100 billion. So when you add it up over 10 years, it's a substantial investment in climate change mitigation and really the most substantial climate legislation we've had in the United States. So the most important tax credits are expansion of the production and investment tax credits that encourage wind, solar, and eventually all zero emissions energy production. There are also important credits for carbon capture and sequestration, for nuclear power, for clean energy manufacturing, and for clean fuels. At the household level, there are tax subsidies that encourage energy efficiency and clean vehicles. And one thing that you should know about these tax credits is they're more generous than the ones in the past. They're accompanied by a direct pay component that makes them easier to use. They're broader in that they cover more industries. They're more certain in that they don't sunset as quickly. And that's all really helpful. There are also some additional features of these credits that are potentially more worrisome. There are somewhat controversially, and in my view, somewhat misguided additional credits that require domestic content in order to get the full amount of the credit. And there's also adders for labor standards that are directed at having higher wage jobs. You know, and those features, I think, are there in part for political reasons, but they also might reduce the effectiveness of those credits. On the spending side, IRA spends money on a lot of energy efficiency and transition features, including conservation, sequestration, energy loans, and energy efficiency. But when you look at the whole package, I think the reason it takes this form rather than the United States government focusing on regulation or on more cost-imposing measures, is it's because this is what was, you know, politically possible to build the coalition to really seriously address this problem. And some of those other approaches might either hit court challenge or would just not get enough votes in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. So maybe can you just elaborate a little bit on these domestic content requirements? So to take the, say, specific example of electric vehicle subsidies, so my understanding is that if you buy an electric vehicle that's not too expensive and you're not too rich, then you get a $7,500 tax credit, which means it's like getting a check, right? But it only works if the vehicle has been assembled in North America, I mean, in the US or in one of the Canada or Mexico. And then there are some requirements on where the stuff that's in the vehicle has been produced, right? Can you just go in? And so can you explain how that would work and how it potentially, we'll talk about competitiveness later, but just on the facts, how that might exclude some producers from the benefits of this tax credit.
Yeah, so there are various conditions. It includes final assembly of the vehicle that must take place in North America. A share of both critical minerals and battery components must come from North America to get the full credit, right? So if you want the full credit, it's fairly restrictive. And some of these requirements dial up over time, such that the fraction that is required to be, you know, in compliance with these domestic content requirements increases over time. There are some, how should I put it? There's some flexibility in some areas. For instance, you know, the leased vehicles will qualify for the credits regardless of these requirements on battery sourcing or caps. And if you look at the importance of leased vehicles in this space, they are actually quite important. So that does provide some reassurance to those that might not qualify otherwise, that they might be able to use this leasing restriction, this leasing provision to get around that. But you know, you can see why these requirements are controversial.
Right. And then there's some specific sort of anti-China, Russia, Iran, North Korea thing. So if there is, I think, you know, a Chinese battery that would disqualify the vehicle from receiving a credit. So that sort of for countries like European countries that are neither North America nor are China, that I guess cuts both ways, right? So it may redirect some demand towards those third countries, but then, you know, for China, it's very bad, obviously, right?
Yeah, I think the provisions within the agreement single out countries where there are national security concerns, right? So I think it does create these sort of gray areas. What if a country is neither a free trade agreement partner nor a national security? You know, then they have kind of a mixed situation, given the way that that's designed. Yeah,
right. Which is, I guess, where most of the world would sit in. Maybe just one more question before we get to the implications. So, if there are also tax credits for producing what you might call clean tech, right? So, for example, photovoltaic technology, hydrogen technology, air turbines, stuff like that. So those tax credits for either producing or investing in facilities that produce things, those don't really have local content requirements, right? But this is about just producing in the US, right? In this case, not North America, just about producing in the US. But in principle, though, if a European company decides, let's build a factory in the US, it could still rely on its normal supply chain, right? And it would get the same treatment as a US company producing in the US. So what's common is that you have to produce in the US. You can't produce in Europe to get this, but you do not get more sort of restrictions. Is that correct?
That's correct. The wind and solar credits do have an adder for domestic steel, so that you get a little bit more credit if you have you know, domestic sourced steel, for instance. But, you know, in general, what you said is true. Yeah.
Right. But here you are referring to what I think is a separate category. So these are subsidies for producing clean electricity, right? Which is essentially what Germany has been doing for the last 20 years almost. So this is the same idea. You sort of subsidize the unit of electricity that's produced. And here, you know, the subsidy gets a little bit of a bonus if it's produced only with facilities that use American steel, right? But in principle, again, this is a credit that would, you know, greatly subsidize renewable electricity production in the US. And so in principle, all the inputs that you might need for that electricity production would benefit from that subsidy, except that if these are US inputs, they benefit a bit more, right? And it's fair to say that this is a very large part of the IRA, right? So a large part of the IRA, in a sense, tries to mimic what has been going on in Europe for a while, albeit with that little added bonus. Okay, so before I'm very keen to get to Sébastien, but before we go there, Kim, can you give us a sense, you know, how good is the IRA for just, you know, the fight against climate change? I mean, maybe both in the US and internationally.
Yes, that's a good question. So estimates suggest that the IRA is going to be effective in reducing US greenhouse gas emissions. And that's, you know, a benefit to the United States in terms of meeting or coming closer to meeting our Paris commitments. But it's also, of course, a benefit to the entire world because this is a global externality. So action in one country helps others. If you look at estimates by researchers who look at these questions, U.S. greenhouse gas emissions were already forecast to decrease by about 30% by 2030 if you compare to the 2005 levels. What the IRA does is it takes that sort of median estimate from 30% to 40%. And given that the Paris goal was about 50%, it sort of gets you halfway to the Paris goal. So that's, you know, that halfway is way better than you know, not halfway, you know, in terms of, well, I guess it's kind of four, you know, depending on what you count as the baseline relative to what we would have achieved otherwise, you know, just on the current trajectory, because there was some decarbonization occurring otherwise, you know, so it's certainly helpful. It's not getting us absolutely all the way there. There's going to be more actions that need to be taken in the future, but I think it does represent, you know, much bolder and more extensive climate legislation than we've had previously. In terms of what that means for decarbonization in the rest of the world, I think there's, you know, different effects here. There's some beneficial effects to the extent that U.S. industries expand in key innovative areas in ways that drive down costs worldwide, either because of scale, because, you know, it just makes more sense to make some of this equipment at a larger scale once the U.S. is demanding a lot of it too, or because of learning effects where industry-wide, you know, costs can go down because people have learned new things about some of these nascent industries that are also being encouraged through the IRA tax credit. So that's a very positive effect. You know, there are also, of course, some concerns. You might worry that if there are scarce energy inputs like key experts or critical minerals, which have been discussed a lot in this area, that if one country, you know, uses a lot of the world's lithium, for instance, that's less lithium for the other countries, right? So there may be some crowding out concerns, and that's going to generate some worries for trading partners, even if we ignore the local content requirements, which are themselves, you know, distortionary. We have to worry a little bit about those kinds of effects too. You know, I would point out that on net, you know, the green industries are going to be expanding throughout the world, right? And the more that we can kind of move resources toward clean energy and away from dirty energy, I think the better. But, you know, there are elements here, at least in the short run, of competition in the sense that there may be key expertise or minerals that the countries are finding.
Right. Fair enough. Sébastien, how do you see the decarbonization impact of the IRA, particularly outside the U.S.?
When I think about the impact on decarbonization of other countries and in particular in the EU, I first think about the political externalities. Because I think when you ask people about their willingness to accept meaningful changes in their behavior, in their way of life, one of the first thing that comes up is that they will accept to change is if others do so. That was clear, for instance, in a recent OECD study about political support for climate policies. So in coping with climate change at the international level, we're facing a big threat of climate inaction. And that's, to me, the first order effect of IRA. It's the first time the US comes up with a serious, significant, big policy effort to fight climate change. And so this is a big plus, and I think this is the most important impact, okay? And it's helpful, certainly not sufficient, but it's helpful to avoid a complete failure of international coordination in that respect. Now, the second second externality, of course, is technological, and Kim was referring to it, and I fully agree. That's really important. We know that these are technologies on which the curve, the learning curve, is quite steep in terms of cost, included in terms of material inputs. It's been moving forward, improving very quickly, but heavy investments are needed to do so, and that will benefit more broadly. Now, of course, there are also competition effects on several aspects, on capital investment, on raw materials, on skills. So perhaps the first question is there a risk, a threat of crowding out of investment in the EU? I'm not so sure, in the sense that I don't think we are living in a macroeconomic framework that is marked by that can be characterized by the scarcity of capital. Of course, you need to make sure that big firms will also invest in the EU if they find profitable investment in the US as well. But I think the main condition to make that possible is to put in place the policies to offer reasonable profitability prospects for investment in the EU. It's not so much in the US that the answer will lie for this question. So, because I don't think the IRA will significantly lower profitability in the EU market. Is there a scarcity of skills? Probably that's possibly more important. And maybe it's a big part of the story. But here, and I would have the same reply for competition over raw material, which is also something clear and present. I think the answer to this question is not to avoid investing in green technology. We all need all countries to invest heavily to fight climate change. So this will, of course, increase a lot the needs in many respects. These technologies are heavily capitalistic. We will need more investment. These technologies imply heavy needs in a number of raw materials. There will be as well competitions there. But not investing or having other countries not making significant effort is not a reply to that concern. I would add an additional thing, which I think is important in that context, is that technical change is not neutral. It's directed. And you just have to look how the use of silicon per unit of power of solar panels has fallen over 20 years. It's spectacular. You also can look at the effort by some firms to develop batteries not using a given component because they know it is scarce. So this is endogenous. In the short term, it may not be very easy to see, but in the long term, it matters a lot. So that's also, I think, something important to take into account.
Right. So to the extent that there is a crowding out effect, and it may well be, it's not really an argument against the IRA from an emissions reduction perspective, because any real push to reduce emissions anywhere in the world through new technology is going to lead to crowding out, right? So this is completely inevitable. So unless you want to slow the speed of decarbonization, you're going to be faced with this problem. It's not an IRA specific problem. But there's one, of course, set of issues with the IRA that may have broader negative implications, including on decarbonization in other countries, and those are the trade policy implications. So, if I think of arguments for why the IRA may not be so good, you know, in general, but particularly also on decarbonization, say in the global south, I think of trade policy reactions in those countries that maybe then might lead them to not benefit from the global cost digression, or particularly from the cost digression in the US, because, you know, just importing the cheap, clean tech stuff from the US might not be an option in real life, given trade policy reactions, given the political economy in these countries. And so this is where we should talk more about, so the interactions between the IRA and trade policy. So, Kim, can you maybe start with that? So what are the trade policy implications of the IRA? So I understand that, you know, some of these measures that are in there are conflict with global trade rules. And then, of course, there are effects on competitiveness, even if the IRA measures do not conflict with global trade rules. So just take us a bit through that, please.
Yes, so I think there's so many interesting facets of that question. First, you know, we sometimes worry about subsidies in general tilting the playing field, and you see this in a lot of trade disputes around aircraft is just one example. You know, if one country subsidizes their aircraft producers and other countries, aircraft producers will object, you know, and that's been a longstanding source of trade friction between Europe and the United States. So anytime there's a subsidy, people do worry about that. I do think these green subsidies are somewhat of a character different, because there's really a sort of Pigouvian argument for saying that there's too little investment in this area relative to what would be optimal when we acknowledge the negative externalities associated with carbon emission and the positive benefits associated with learning and innovation in this area.
So by Pigouvian argument, you mean that?
Yeah. So just to clarify, what I mean is that we don't trust, like we might trust in some sectors like computers or something, that the market is going to generate the right number of computers. But we don't think in energy that the market left to its own devices is going to internalize the externalities that are created by carbon emissions, is one example, which is what the most important externality in the world. So when we think about a Pigouvian response to that, we're like, how do we get that price right? Like one way to do it is to tax carbon, right? Because you reduce the use of carbon by all producers and consumers. If you can't tax carbon, right, another option is to subsidize non-carbon, right? And maybe taxing carbon is first best, but if you can't get there, another way to benefit is to say, okay, well, maybe we can encourage the opposite of carbon. And there's also sort of potential, at least, for learning externalities and spillover effects like those we've discussed earlier. So, you know, even though subsidies, I think, in some markets that don't have these externalities, I think are quite worrisome and are things that we'd want to kind of have rules to avoid, like the European state aid rules are an example. I do think this area is, we might worry a little less about that, given those externality issues. The domestic content rules, on the other hand, I think there's very little argument for them. I think it's distortionary, clearly. It lessens the effectiveness of the measures to have to, you know, jump through hoops in order to qualify for the full credit. You might actually end up with less emissions reduction than you would, right, if you didn't have these domestic content requirements, to say nothing of the fact that you're alienating some of your closest partners and friends who view their industries as perhaps, also in some sort of competition now with the United States, right? So I think that part was, in my view, wrongheaded, both for environmental reasons, because it makes the IRA less effective in emissions reduction, but also for trade reasons. Like, we want to work in a collaborative way with people throughout the world to solve this problem, right? So this raises, you know, this sort of more general problem that we have in this area of competitiveness, which is that, you know, if we have some countries that are subsidizing and other countries that are imposing costs, right, that's going to lead to concerns in the cost-imposing jurisdictions that their firms are disadvantaged relative to those in the subsidy-imposing jurisdictions. So, you know, I think it's important that people be cognizant of those problems and think creatively about solutions and ways to coordinate, you know, to get a more effective global outcome.
Got it. And we're going to talk about how these more, if you like, systemic solutions might look like later. But before we do that, Sébastien, can you explain a little bit the EU concerns? So the IRA was initially pretty much welcomed, I think, in the EU on the grounds that it is a huge step forward on global climate policy, and then sort of this sense started trickling in. It's like, oops, there's some really bad protectionism in there, which is the local content requirement that Kim talked about. But then, you know, just the sheer strength of the subsidy in some areas might actually persuade European companies to move to the US, and that's maybe not good for EU workers. Can you explain this a little bit, and then we'll get to how the EU should react?
Yeah, I think there are probably three main problems seen from the EU point of view. Two have to do with unfair competition, and the third one has to do with subsidies and the potential impact. I think with regard to competition fairness, clearly there are in particular provisions linked to the fact that consumer tax credits are conditional on local assembly in North America. That's clearly in contradiction with national treatment principle. So the concern for the EU is that their producers won't be competitive in the US market due to this requirement. That's the first thing. Then you mentioned the local content requirement on production or investment tax credits. That's also a concern about unfair competition in that respect, in benefiting from these subsidies. And that's also in clear contradiction with the commitments taken by the US in WTO agreements. And then the third one is about subsidy. And here, subsidies are not outright prohibited by the agreement of on subsidies and countervailing measures, but they should not be linked to local content requirement first. And secondly, they are actionable if you can prove that they are causing industrial or trade prejudice to the partner country. Now, is that the case here? If we take apart the question of fairness of this of compatibility with national principle, if we just stick and focus on the volume of subsidies, then I don't think it's disproportionate compared to what is done in the EU. Actually, I think it is lower because that's the amount. Sounds as something huge. We talk about in total, for the climate part, $369 billion. But that's over 10 years, and that's for the US economy, which is a big economy. In percentage term, it's less than 0.2% yearly of the US GDP. Even if you include other subsidies like the ones in the CHIP Act, the one in the Infrastructure Act, the one provided by state, in particular in California, for instance, you have a very big program, then everything included, you're probably not much above 0.4% of yearly of GDP. Now, if you compare to what is done presently, what is planned in the EU, in the present budget framework, over the next 7 years, we're planning to have 30% of the budget devoted to climate action. That's in terms of GDP equivalent yearly. I mean, that's back of the envelope calculations, of course, but it's the amount is between 500 and 600 billion euros, and that's a bit more than 0.5% of GDP. So that's larger. Possibly,
this is not all subsidies, right? this would not be all subsidies. This is
not also, all subsidies, of course. Yes, but that, this is all budget expenses related to climate action. And if you talk about developing renewable energies, as is done by part of the IRA and a big part of it, then to some extent it could be comparable. So I'm not sure there is big disproportion here, even though the forms this expenditure, public expenditures are taking are different.
Mm-hmm. Right. So maybe to summarize, the IRA is unambiguously good, I would say, from a global decarbonization perspective, certainly if you count in the effect on US emissions, which is the primary target. It's unambiguously bad from the perspective of disrespecting global trade rules, and this is the issue of the use of prohibited subsidies, so subsidies that we already know, the US knew at the time when it was legislating this, would be inconsistent with WTO rules. And by the way, I could just add that according to my trade policy colleagues here at Bruegel, it's actually the first time that the US has legislated a local content requirement. So it's a particularly sort of blatant step, if you like. And then we have the issue of competitiveness, where the IRA is bad for the rest of the world. And, you know, this is sort of the intention, because competitiveness is fundamentally a zero-sum concept. But then the question is, how much should Europeans complain about this when they themselves subsidize quite a lot? And maybe the one thing here to say is that, yes, we do subsidize quite a lot, but certainly in the area of subsidizing renewables, electricity, you know, the big difference between say the German subsidies, the US subsidies, is that there are no local content requirements in the German subsidies. The other big difference, of course, is that the IRA's subsidies seem to be structured in a way that's particularly attractive to firms, including European firms. And this has led many in Europe to say, why don't we do the same? So why don't we just replicate this sort of very simple and rather generous subsidy structure, particularly in the area of clean tech production and investment? And, you know, why don't we do it by, say, loosening our state aid rules, which is our framework within the European Union to avoid a subsidies race, and where essentially countries that want to do these sorts of subsidies have to ask for permission in Brussels, and the European Commission then has fairly strict criteria whether it gives it. So one idea is, let's just, you know, be easier and just have more subsidies on the side of the member states. So, Sebastian, what do you think of sort of the EU response? What should it be? What policy instruments should it use? Should it be trade policy? Should it be subsidies? Should it be something else?
So let me first perhaps say a bit about the competitiveness impact, a bit more, because does it matter? Yes, of course it matters. It matters a lot in the US market. Why? Because the tax credit is large. We're talking about $7,500 per car. That's potentially 15% of the price. We're talking about large subsidies, including with significant provisions on local content for renewable energies. So I think it makes a significant difference in the US market. But you also have to take into account the fact that the local content requirement is a drag on competitiveness on foreign market for the producers. So the impact on the European market, if you're thinking about electric vehicles, will be very different. Okay, there will be disadvantage on the contrary. And you can add to that the fact that import duties on vehicles are larger in the EU. They are 10% than in the US at 2.5%, except for China because of the additional duties which are ongoing. Even for batteries, they are slightly higher in the US. So For electric vehicles, a significant impact in the US market, but not necessarily elsewhere. For hydrogen, for instance, hydrogen is extremely costly to transport. So I'm not sure about, I don't want to be really affirmative in that respect because I'm not a specialist, but I'm not sure, it's not clear to me that the economic impact on third market on outside the US will be very significant. And now if you talking about renewable energies, as we were saying before, the subsidies in the EU are important as well. So here again, there will be a strong impact in the US market. I'm not sure it will be strong elsewhere. Now, it is a problem for us that to see that they are going in that direction of non-cooperative policies. That's a thing, but...
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that these local content requirements or this conditionality of consumption tax credits is non-cooperative, clearly. But the effect outside the US markets, I think, will not be so strong. Now, should we do the same thing? Here, I think what is important is to come back to what I was emphasizing at the beginning. That's the first serious policy effort by the US. Why? My understanding is that because this is the way they have finally found to build a political coalition between Greens, between people focusing on industry and people focusing on labor. To have a big policy action, okay, and that was extremely difficult to achieve. So I think there is nothing else on offer, and we need to be pragmatic from a political point of view. There is no, of course, there is much to dislike in this in the way it is built, in the way it is framed, but there is nothing else on offer, and this is far better than nothing. So what is the bottom line for us? Should we do the same? I'm not sure. I mean, we should also make sure that we can move forward in a decided way and build the relevant coalitions to do so. Does it mean doing the same as in the US? I don't think so, because we are not in the same political situation. So I think we should do mainly three kind of, perhaps two things to avoid, and then three things to do. The two things to avoid is, first, avoid direct confrontation with the US when it is possible. It does not mean that we should not negotiate and negotiate hard to make sure that we are not disadvantaged or that the disadvantage is reduced to a minimum. But a confrontation, I think, would not be good in that respect. The second thing we need to avoid is to feed non-cooperative responses at global level, because that's a big threat. The US, the EU are big actors. They have systemic responsibilities in the multilateral trading system, and they need to be aware of that. Now, what can we do? I think we can do three things. We can limit direct impact, we can invest, and we can defend ourselves. Limit the direct impact. It means putting pressure on the US in the negotiation. That's, I mean, the ongoing process. It's more for policymakers to do that as well as they can. And it's logical not to exclude actions, for instance, in the WTO, if it is a way also to gain leverage upon the US. We need to invest, of course, as the industrial plan for the Green Deal has been announced, and we need to go big in that respect because that's a big challenge, and we'll certainly go back to that. And we need to defend ourselves because we cannot either accept to be facing unfair competition. So I think when telling this, I'm thinking about a few things in particular. First, public markets. I mean, if the US is reserving public markets for local producers, I think we should do the same in the EU, at least with regard to US producers. No reason to not have a reciprocal approach to that. Second...
What do you mean by public markets?
Public procurement.
And this is something we could do under existing EU legislation, where the tool...
Exactly, the new tool called International Procurement Instrument, and it's brand new. Let's use it. If we cannot find a negotiated solution. We also have a brand new tool on subsidies to avoid distortions through acquisitions, so through investment in the single market, if it comes from subsidized competitors. I think we also should use it. And the third thing is also concern about subsidized exports. And here, I think we need also to set the priorities well. What is the direct threat on EU producers right now? It's not coming from the US. It's coming from China. European import from Chinese electric vehicles have multiplied by 2.5, more than 2.5 in 1 year. And this is a massively subsidized industry in China. So I'm asking the question, aren't we at risk of making the same mistake today with electric vehicles that we made 15 years ago with solar panels? I think there is a big question, a big stake in thinking about the usefulness of using or planning perhaps in the future countervailing measures in that respect. I know this is very difficult because part of the importers are European automakers, BMW, Renault, for instance. I know it's difficult also because we don't have enough production capacities yet in Europe. So it might be costly, but I think it's a big question and probably more urgent in terms of trade in terms of industrial stake than answering to IRA.
Right. So that would be a more robust trade policy response against subsidized products, in this case from China, which in a sense are more threatening to European industry. Can I just ask you about one thing, though? So you said, let's not be confrontational vis-a-vis the US, but then you said, let's use the procurement tool and let's use tools that can prevent direct investment if the companies are using subsidies. So that first would seem reasonably confrontational, but also it's sort of, I think, misses a little bit the point, because I don't think the IRA has anything in it that would really discriminate against European products in US procurement markets, right? This is, I think, a little bit distinct. But the one obvious thing that it does is it has, illegal subsidies in it because of the local content requirement. So would it not make sense to take the US to the WTO over this, just to sort of demonstrate that this is wrong? Or do you consider this too confrontational?
I'm not sure this would be useful. Thinking about dealing with climate change at the global level, I would say we're facing two kinds of big threat. One is a threat of confrontation, of trade war, if you like. But the second one is a threat of inaction. So how important is IRA? What's the news in IRA? The first news to me is that finally the US is moving. So are we going to oppose this move because it does not fit exactly the rules? And because I think we should perhaps frame it a bit differently and say, okay, it's not the way we would like it to be, but it's here. Let's see how we minimize the damage first and how we can agree about adapting trade rules or perhaps our reactions so that we minimize the unleveling of the playing field, if I may put it that way. And just what I want to add is that the kind of responses and tools I was mentioning are tools that are lawful consistent with our international commitments. They are codified. It's not something.
Right. Right. Kim, you have the last word. How should the EU react? Do you agree with Sebastian? I was a bit surprised that he was so tame on the trade policy reaction. Since we have had, you know, these types of conflicts, and as long as we follow WTO rules in carrying them out, it doesn't seem to have affected the broader relationship very, very much. Anyway, what do you agree with, and what do you disagree with what Sebastian has just said, and what is missing, if anything?
I agree with a lot of what he said. I think it's very important to keep the eye on the ball and focus on the number one problem, which is this huge threat to the world's climate of policy and action. And so I think the more that Europe and the United States can work together and coordinate and applaud each other's efforts in this area, the better. I do think it's completely appropriate for the Europeans to be dismayed by the local content requirements. And I do think it does suggest that the time is kind of past due for us to really put our heads together and think about ways to do reforms to the WTO that enable countries to pursue, diverse approaches to climate change mitigation, but that also maintain the spirit of the WTO in terms of creating a sound rules-based system that is non-discriminatory and that enables countries to, you know, make progress on a host of issues while, you know, increasing standards of living throughout the world. The WTO has been incredibly successful in the past, and I don't think we should just toss it to the side because, you know, there's some pressing problems. You know, as one example, I think trade negotiations could be really helpful in furthering climate aims, both in ensuring that this knowledge that is accumulated through things like the IRA investments can spill over across borders and making sure that everyone benefits from that, but also to sort of address the enormous tilts in the playing field right now in favor of dirty industries rather than clean industries. There's some really nice empirical work that's been done recently showing that the current structure of tariffs and trade barriers is really like tilting the playing field in favor of a dirty planet rather than a clean one, right? So this is something that I think would be great if countries could come together and work on. So, I'm hopeful of that. I also think that there are areas where the United States could learn from Europe. I mean, we've been focusing on ways that Europe might adapt to what the US is doing. But one example would be learning from their successful imposition of a trading system that puts a real price on carbon and that has been quite effective. And I realize that, that comes with some costs, right, in terms of how we think about it. But there are ways to mitigate those costs to industry. If you say, you know, we can start with a system of free allowances like Europe has done and then like some of the Canadians have done too. We can think about accompanying this with carbon border adjustment to address the potential leakage concerns or competitiveness effects that companies would have if you start to phase out those free allowances. And carbon border adjustments can be a way to sort of say to domestic industry, listen, we understand that you're cleaner than some of your counterparts abroad, you know, outside of Europe and the United States. Like if you compare the emissions content of steel or chemicals made in China to that made in the United States or Europe, you'll see that actually like a carbon border adjustment would be advantageous to US or European industry, right? So there might be ways to coordinate on that regard. And that might even encourage useful adoption in other countries, right? I know that when Turkey had talked about, you know, moving towards pricing carbon in part to avoid getting hit by European carbon border adjustments, that can be a model for sort of encouraging third countries to say like, listen, we should all kind of work together to kind of join the club, to do things that are serious in this regard and to make sure that it's helping the world.
Absolutely. Kim, Sebastian, we are out of time. We're over time, in fact. So thank you both so very much. Very constructive transatlantic conversation. I hope it will be as constructive among our politicians and that we'll find negotiated solutions and hopefully multilateral ones. So Thank you so much. Next week, by the way, we will publish a policy brief on this issue that is not completely aligned with what you said, but in many important points it is aligned, and you can read it on our website www.bruegel.org. And thank you so much again. Thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. Until next time. Bye-bye.